Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. This morning I'm going to read an interview with QP Zeke by Studs Terkel. But first, a little bit of a prologue, because it has been 25 years since Bob QP Zeke died in the summer of 1990 at age 73. He was universally known as QP because, according to legend, a cowlick of hair stuck up from his head when he was born, or just thereafter. Studs Terkel interviewed QP in 1980, 10 years before QP's death in the summer of 1990. The interview appeared in Terkel's book, American Dreams, Lost and Found, published in 1981 by Pantheon Books. QP Zeke was born in 1917 and fought in World War II in the Philippines and other places in the Pacific. He was a rare and singular man. He was inspiringly eloquent, with a good-humored lilt to his deep-chested basso voice. He could be as scathing or as oratorical as an old Roman senator. He was a man of the woods who was legendary for his courage and protection of wildlife. He created a sanctuary for birds and animals along the Columbia River and risked his life to defend eagles and their nest trees, almost single-handedly forcing timber companies to stop cutting the trees. He protected salmon spawning grounds from the depredations of a mining company and helped stop construction of an aluminum smelter that would have grossly polluted the lower Columbia estuary. He hunted bear hunters with his fists and guns. He was nationally known as the environmentalist logger for his practices of sustainable logging and reforesting timber on his land near Napa. He thought in terms of centuries, expressed through the cycles of his beloved forest. History might regard his legacy as lasting. I knew who QP was long before I met him, and for the last 5 years of his life, I saw him once or twice a week, usually in an Astoria coffee place where he talked with everybody and genially reparteed with the hired help. He often brought flowers and chocolates for the waitresses. He treated everyone the same, friend and foe, stranger and kin, straight in the eye and never mincing his words or passion, although he tempered his profundity with fellowship and humor. Something he said to Studs Terkel might well be his own metaphor. Before I die, I'd like to hear the howl of timber wolves that used to exist here in our woods. His howl is greatly missed and needed more than ever. So listen to this interview as though you are listening to the thunder of his deep voice in your ear. Even when he spoke quietly, he rumbled like a storm over a nearby hill. The interview. Studs Terkel. We're in logging country, Napa, Oregon. It is near the mouth of the Columbia River. He's a chunky, muscular man, built along the lines of Hack Wilson, the old Chicago Cubs slugger. He is 62. Enthusiastically, he talks of the vast coniferous forest. You're always aware of the scent of trees if you're a logger. It turns you on. You know you've struck a cedar that may have been buried in the ground for a couple of hundred years. The beauty's going. The old timber that was majestic has been eliminated. In the old days, the Douglas fir was mixed with Sitka spruce, western hemlock, and the great cedars. All through the woods, you found a beautiful mix of trees. Today, trees are planted in predetermined distances apart. It is something to be controlled. The forest, to me, is an awesome and beautiful place. You can see this little baby elk that we have in the woods here. Isn't it a little beautiful, cuddly thing? But watch that elk grow, and eventually he becomes a magnificent bull with a huge rack of antlers, a deep chest, and proud eyes. He's not cute and cuddly anymore. He is awesome. That's the way it is with trees. You see cute little Christmas trees you'll put on the table. They're immature little things. They have not attained the magnificence that nature puts on these trees at 500 years. They take on character. They're always in a battle. The wind's after them. The lightning's after them. The timber companies don't want a single tree standing anymore. They don't understand that a tree, a snag, is not only a hotel for birds and bats and bees. They are magnificent works of art created by nature and beyond the ability of man to equal. There's a tree down the road here a few miles that's over 10 feet in diameter at the butt. At the very tip top of it is a magnificent crown of jewels, a nest of bald-headed eagles. Timber companies are indifferent to your feelings. I don't think they have any feeling for beauty, for something that is old. The only feeling they want is the tons of pulp to come out of there. Today, when they come to a canyon, they start switchbacking, crisscrossing back and forth with bulldozers, tearing up the ground, silting the creeks, and putting 5 acres of ground out of production per mile of road. Old-time loggers were not able to reach many of the rough places, so these patches and trees were left. The younger loggers were not here to see what there was before. If you've never known something, it's difficult to appreciate what has been lost. I was born and lived here in a logging camp. My dad was a logger. He was a big, raw-boned, powerful man of a very happy nature. I can see him coming home now with his logging clothes on, a rifle in his hand and a deer on his back. The first sounds I can remember are the voices of loggers and the sounds of locomotives and steam donkeys. As a kid, it seemed to me more plentiful of everything. The forests were still virgin. There were fish in the sloughs, lots of waterfowl, and it was a very happy time. No one can grow up here and not be aware of the birds and animals and the river. It gets in your blood, in your thinking, in your way of life. In the old days, when you approached a lumber camp, you began to feel the tempo, the intensity, the turmoil. It was something like a war zone. You could see loggers everywhere, going somewhere, coming back. There are always locomotives moving, backing out, switching. You'd hear the sound of the pop-off valves of escaping steam and the smells of crude oil. There was always excitement there. They had the old highball days. You really traveled. One tough old hook tender told a new man, "We don't walk around here. We don't run around here. We fly." There were frequent accidents, broken arms, broken hips, men just killed outright. The camp was a little company town. They had some fellows they called wobblies, organizers. These were IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, who fought bloody union wars organizing Pacific Northwest logging camps in the early years of the 20th century. They tarred and feathered them up here at Big Creek, made them walk nude down the tracks. My mother remembers that. She was brokenhearted about what they did to those men. Turkle, who's they? Cupie, the company men, who were afraid of losing their jobs. They had no protection, so they took it out on the wobblies. Old-timers used to talk about firings. They had 3 crews, one working, one coming from the labor pool, and one going. Work was tough. The methods weren't safe. They were running the men too hard, driving them, working them too long hours and too many days. If the company didn't like you for one reason or another, they fired you. My dad was a union man. Today, all of us loggers belong to the union. My sister still has her union book at home. As a young girl, she was a waitress in the cookhouse. It was a large dining room. They rang the gong, and that was time to eat. The food was good, and they ate heartily. You hardly saw a fat logger in those days. They were all raw-boned. It was very physical work. The machinery has taken over so much of that today. I can remember yet the fallers that were falling trees. The saw, not a power saw, made a beautiful swish, 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 a rhythm to it. These men had no shirts on, just down to their wool underwear, each one with a big chew of tobacco in his mouth. One stopped and looked at his partner and said, "Get off and let me ride for a while," meaning he was doing all the work. Each man excelled in his own part. Your value as a faller meant not only how much timber you could put down, but how much you could save. Long before the tree ever came down, you would hear them holler, "Timber!" He sings it, and his voice fades to a last dying note. And that's Studs, back to Kewpie. That call would go down the hill and all through the canyons. The timber is getting so much smaller now. Logging can't be compared to what it was before. Something wild, something beautiful, something free. It's gone. I've been on the hills here and can see so far away all this logged off land. It's almost impossible for me to comprehend that mere men destroyed all this timber. Every foot of that ground has been stomped by men. What happened to all that timber? It's one of the few things in the world that boggles my imagination. Sure, some of the animals are dangerous to you. They are after your life. They have crippled many guys and killed people. They're wild in another way now. They're wild from being pursued by people in four-wheel drives, campers. I don't kill anymore. I was very young when I quit. When I'd kill something and watch it die and look at the eyes, I knew I'd taken what attracted me in the first place, a life. What did I have but a carcass? And I wasn't hungry. I just quit killing because I took the beauty of the animal, the deer or elk or bear. If it was a duck, I'd want to smooth its feathers when it was dead and stiffened up, that it wouldn't look obscene. The animals aren't wild anymore, just pursued. We've just gone through a cow elk season to thin them out. The forestry department said there were too many, too much damage to young trees. They were killing these elk at a time when it was an absolute disgrace. The vegetation was completely frozen out. The cows, heavy with calves, would bunch up in the timber and lie there very still, conserving their body fat and heat to get through this starving period, yet the hunters are out there pursuing them. I have a little sanctuary down here, and I'd see big, beautiful honkers coming in, Canadian geese. They're free. I don't pinion them. To pinion a bird is like cutting off the leg of a child to keep it from running around. It turns you off to see them drop, a leg spinning, dangling on a thick piece of skin, shot by hunters. Guns go out there and shoot too many. There's no time to pick them up. They're thrown away. Before I die, I'd like to hear the howl of timber wolves that used to exist here in our woods. We have too damn many hunters and no wolves. We need more cougars, less hunters. Bears are fair game, too. When a bear damages a tree, what he actually does is set that tree to produce more seeds. I've taken 10-foot stumps and found in the very center bear marks that the tree may have received 500 years ago, just as good as they are today. So bears aren't all that bad. We asked the timber company, how many goddamn bears will you allow? I'm a believer that the animals and birds have some inherent right to the land. The man can't say, I own this, everything else off. We had a ruckus with a pack of houndsmen over the killing of bears, killing them left and right. Hounds are worth thousands of dollars, and the houndsmen are really well organized with a powerful lobby. It was a fist fight. Fortunately, I'm able to take care of myself pretty well. There was a pickup truck with a bunch of guys in it. As I was walking to my truck, one of the fellows motioned me over. We'd had bad blood many times before. He once knocked on my mother's door and told her, if any of your sons touches one of my hounds, I'll kill every goddamn one of them. I saw him again when he was found guilty of killing bears out of season. Outside the courthouse, we almost came to blows. This time, as I drove up, he punched me right in the face through the window. I piled out and was able to neutralize the fellow. I had him about 1 foot apart, my face from his. He spat a mouthful of snus right in my face. I immediately changed the look of his mouth with a good smash to his face. He got back in the truck, and I've had no trouble with him since. I've been threatened, telephone calls to be killed. It was so tense for a while that I had to carry a pistol. Many times I'm alone in the woods, running a big cat, miles back there. Houndsmen are on these roads. They're all equipped with knives, rifles. It would be the easiest thing in the world to put a bullet through my head over in some canyon. Sometimes people are hesitant to make a move, even though they know it's right. I was walking up this road with a company man. Lo and behold, here are some beautiful big bear tracks. She's in here, an old sow, probably got some cubs. We can't let the houndsmen see her. They have a network. One guy tells another, and down they come with their hounds. This company man, he had about number 10 size shoes, was going up the road, scuffing out the bear tracks. He was protecting the bears when his job said to get rid of them. Innermost in many men are subconscious desires they don't allow to surface. I only express my thoughts to people who understand what I'm talking about. Many don't care, don't feel, but there are surprising ones who will help. I got a letter from a man who works for a big lumber company. It says, "You stepped on my toes many times. I'm ready to retire now, and I want you to know I'm for you. I don't care to let you know who I am because they'll send me off to Siberia." Many people's voices are stilled because of the position they're in. I happen to be a single man, and it will be pretty hard to starve me. So I can say what the hell I want. When my father died, I quit the woods and took an early retirement. I logged my own place. The chance to live my life out without being a rich man is probably the greatest gift that any person could receive. I have no feeling that I've ever been beaten or that I'm a poor man. I'm rich in many things. I feel I have a responsibility while on this earth to preserve some beauty and pass it on to the next generation. Because if I do not pass something on, these children and their children's children will have a barren world. I believe that only by being in the presence of beauty and the great things in the world around us can man get the goddamn hatred of wanting to kill each other out of his system. We begin to understand that we're only in this world such a short time. It's incredible we should spend these few years hating and killing each other. And that was an interview with QP Zeke by Studs Terkel in 1980. And after QP's death, his nephew Rex gave a eulogy. Now Rex Zeke was Bob Zeke's nephew. He lives in Ilwaco, Washington. He's an award-winning photographer and author of In Full View, a true and accurate account of Lewis and Clark's arrival at the Pacific Ocean and their search for a winter camp along the lower Columbia River. And that's the title. He and his wife Keiko have organized a nonprofit group, OBON, to facilitate the return of Japanese battle flags to families of Japanese soldiers killed in World War II. American veterans who took them as war souvenirs have expressed a wish the flags be returned. As I said, Rex wrote and delivered a eulogy to his uncle at QP's funeral, which was on August 22, 1990. And this is Rex's requiem. I was asked by my family to say a few words about QP. It is difficult to do this because it is difficult to believe he is dead. He had been here all my life, and I naturally believed he would be here the rest of my life. As the years went by, some men got old, stooped over, and showed their age, but QP seemed to age much slower. At the age of 73, he was still strong as a bull, wise as an owl, and clever as a fox. I am happy to see that so many friends could be here. However, I naturally think about all of QP's friends who could not attend. In the hills, a black bear strips huckleberries from a bush and mourns QP's death. Over the Columbia River, an eagle teaches its young how to fish and mourns QP's death. The geese that will return from the north and seek refuge in the Napa Slough mourn QP's death. They know they have lost their very best friend. They realize that no one else will defend them. QP spoke for the animals. He was the voice of the voiceless. The animals are crying because they know. They know if a logger is killed, the boss just hires another logger. When a lawyer drops dead, you just find another lawyer. When a senator breathes his last, you just elect another to take his place. But the animals know that no one here or anyone else will follow Kewpie. After all, how many of us here would risk their lives for the life of a bear? How many of us would dare confiscate the guns from poachers? There was only one Kewpie, and there will be no more. Kewpie was a naturalist, a logger, a lover, a poet. He was a historian, an anthropologist, and a storyteller. He could do any of these as equally well as the other. But mostly, Kewpie was a warrior. A warrior in our society is confusing. When we hear of a warrior, we naturally think of a soldier. But a soldier is not a warrior. A soldier is sent into battle, whereas a warrior seeks battle. Kewpie was a warrior, perhaps one of the last. He was constantly in a fight. He seemed to thrive on conflict. He fought with big timber companies. He fought with his neighbors. He fought with poachers, trespassing teenagers, and industrialists. He even fought with his own family. He constantly sought war. We do not understand this. Warriors do not live in this world with our ideals and values. But Kewpie showed us what a fighter can do. Kewpie showed us the power of public opinion. Kewpie showed what an individual can do. In Kewpie's name, please keep up the fight. Speak up about injustices. Defend nature and our environment. This is what Kewpie would have wanted us to do. We will all remember things about Kewpie. It is unlikely we will forget them. Whether it was his deep voice, his poetic words, his thick, powerful hands, or his animated stories, Kewpie will live on. And that was a Requiem for Kewpie by his nephew, Rex Zeek. And by Howard Bruner. He wrote a memoir for the October 1990 issue of the North Coast Times Eagle about Kewpie. He moved later that year from Astoria to Eugene, and like Kewpie, he has fought long and courageously to preserve wildlife and the natural environment. He titled his article, "The Old Warrior Dies," by Howard Bruner. Bob Zeek was a man's man, a two-fisted, barrel-chested warrior who contained elements so anomalous he disarmed his foes through sheer amazement. His arsenal contained guns, fists, heavy machinery, and poetry. A visionary in Kent, Bustams, and Hickory, Kewpie had reached a stage of development far beyond the norm for this woodsy, resource-dependent area. He had gone to the well and found that his life was inextricably wound up with the lives of the creatures and land around him. Perhaps he had caught a glimpse of the place we really are in the scheme of things. He had made the ultimate jump of faith in his denial of free agency without consequences. He accepted the responsibility we godlike humans have for all other forms of life. This hard-living, rough-and-tumble logger was also a gentle and nurturing force in the hundreds of thousands of lives he touched. By setting up and maintaining a sanctuary for game birds in this world-class mecca for fowl hunters, he had more of an effect on the fortunes of dwindling avian populations than will ever be accountable. Long before the counters and oglers put new value on the wonder of the goose V, Kewpie had adopted his feathered brothers and sisters. When the call was made to cut the nest trees of the eagles, he was the man who put his body between further life and the ultimate desolation of an eagleless sanctuary. The bears of these woods had one voice speaking for them. Kewpie refused to let the high-tech, dog-enhanced slaughter go unchallenged and stood his ground against all comers. His was a bravery and commitment the likes of which we will probably not see again. I always had a thrill of anticipation when my travels took me to his magnificent sanctuary, for I was sure to see upwards of 30 species of birds, from passerines, songbirds, to raptors. Depending on the season and weather, a cast of hundreds was always to be enjoyed. And if one was lucky, the man on the tractor, seeing a disciple from his white farmhouse on the hill, would come down to do that which has almost gone the way of extinction. He would come down and pass the time of day. I can recall many times when I found myself transported out of the daily stress performance cycle, having a conversation that was the ultimate in entertainment and relaxation. For Kewpie had that aura of one who was at peace with himself, and although more often than not our subject was centered on those who were less inclined to see the paradise factor in life on this earth. He had the gentle confidence of one who sees past all earthly foibles. Cupy is gone. He is wild and free. Never again will I see the tractor with the dog in the scoop and the jovial mayor of Brownsmead driving. That is not where I will find Cupy. I will find him in a scud-torn autumn sky filled with the urgent cries of his brothers and sisters. I will find him in the winded trees of a spring glade, born on the cathartic edge of wildness. He will always be an integral part of that which he loved and helped, that which now has taken his spirit. And that was by Howard Bruner, The Old Warrior Dies. And as a bit of an epilogue, Cupy was interviewed for a documentary film sponsored by the Clatsop County Historical Society, Steam Whistle Logging. His interviewer was the late Sam Churchill, also son of a logger and raised in a logging camp, and for a time, a logger himself. He was author of a book about his dad, Big Sam, and two other books, Don't Call Me Ma and Say It Again, Sam. He was a World War II Navy veteran and afterward a newspaper columnist. He was also a volunteer programmer for KMUN for several years, primarily hosting a weekly show about early 20th century logging in the Pacific Northwest. Cupy told Sam, "As I go through the woods now and see the hand-planted timber, I feel like I'm walking through a cemetery. It's a carrot patch." And he said that when loggers went to town, they fought a lot and they drank a lot, and they spent a lot of time on Astoria's glorious Astor Street where the girls were. I told one fellow once that Astoria went to hell when they took the red lights off the whorehouses down there and put them up on the intersections. Sam Churchill died the year after Cupy in 1991 at age 80. And Lewis Studs Terkel died at age 96 in 2008. He was like Cupy, a robust activist against rapacious and predatory policies and practices. He was a writer, actor, historian, and radio broadcaster. He is especially remembered for his oral histories of ordinary Americans and for his radio interviews. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1985. He once said, "I want a language that speaks the truth." I think that if Cupy were still alive, he would boisterously oppose LNG and the building of export terminals on his beloved Columbia River to ship shale oil and fracked gas overseas, just as he did AMAX, the never-built aluminum plant in Warrenton. Think of what he said from the interview. "I've been on the hills here and can see so far away. All this logged-off land. It is impossible for me to comprehend that mere men destroyed all this timber. Every foot of that ground has been stomped by man. What happened to all that timber? It's one of the few things in this world that boggles my imagination." Perhaps we might invoke his ghost when we think of the irreversible worldwide climate change caused by mere human beings, which should boggle all